This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and on today's show, talking about the differences between vaccine hesitancy and vaccine skepticism and how this all plays out in society. Joining me today is Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. He is a Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Dakota, and we're talking vaccines in this month's installment of Philosophical Currents.
Yeah, so I was, you know, fiddling around the internet, and I saw someone post the question in response to the CDC's call that you don't have to wear masks if you're vaccinated. Well, how do we know if someone's been vaccinated or not? And someone responded by saying, just ask them who you voted for. Right. And I thought that was really interesting. And I ended up looking at the data. And of course, as has been a topic of conversation for a while now, it turns out to be true that there is significantly more vaccine hesitancy and vaccine skepticism by Republicans than Democrats, and even more so by Trump supporters in Republicans than Republicans who hold other positions. And so what's become clear, and again, this is no surprise to anybody, is that the vaccine issue has become highly politicized and is more about the cluster of beliefs that you have rather than your perception of science or your perception of the safety of the vaccine itself. And so that got me really curious about the network of beliefs that inform this and the way that we make decisions about especially controversial issues that are on the table.
So a significant discrepancy, but give us some more specifics here. What does that data show?
So it's hard to get exact numbers because they're fluid.
Sure.
But looking at the studies of the last 6 months, the number of Republicans who said they were absolutely not going to get vaccine went from about a third to almost a half. And the number of Democrats who said they weren't going to get vaccine was at about 10%. And now those numbers are hard to find, but it looks like it's a little less than that. Interestingly enough, though, the number of Democrats and Republicans who are fully vaccinated is roughly the same. The number of Democrats and Republicans who are actively pursuing the vaccine is the same right now, given the distribution, given the accessibility, given their ages and all of that sort of stuff. But once you get into that group of people who haven't been fully vaccinated yet, the opinions depart radically.
So this is kind of a chicken or the egg question. Which came first, the vaccine hesitancy or the political affiliation?
Well, this is actually one of the things that I find the most fascinating, because the way that we're taught political allegiance in school is that you have a cluster of beliefs. You have an opinion on guns or on abortion or on international relations or on other such things. And then you look for the party that represents your view. But actually, all of the studies show that it's exactly the opposite. You identify, for a variety of reasons, whether it's family or regional or friends, as to what party you're a part of, or what sort of I'll call it denomination of politics you hold. You know, are you liberal? Are you conservative? Are you libertarian? Are you communist? Whatever. And then you choose the positions on the issues that illustrate that you are a good X. You want a position on gun control that illustrates that you're a good Republican or a good Democrat. You want a position on the vaccines that illustrate to other people that you're a good Republican or a good Democrat. And what has become increasingly evident in the last couple of decades is that political affiliation is an identity issue much more than it is a position on political issues or even a position on public policy, that your public policy attitudes are after the fact. So it actually isn't a chicken or the egg question, because it's become pretty clear that your affiliation comes first, and then you adopt the position that is in line with the group of people you want to identify with.
Well, I have been very curious about vaccine hesitancy and vaccine skepticism because it seemed under the previous administration, when that Operation Warp Speed was launched. Many were hailing this as something that was great coming out of the Trump administration, that was putting the money in the hands of the business and not the government. And it really helped to increase the efficiency. And they touted it as why we were able to get vaccines delivered so quickly. And then now, as you said, the data showing that the supporters of that administration are among the least likely to get vaccinated. How do you describe that, what seems to me to be a discrepancy in thinking?
So there's two separate things going on. The first thing is that Operation Warp Speed was a way of moving this towards the private sector, but it ignores the fact that the research on this kind of vaccine has been going on for decades and decades. So it's not like, as some people portray it, COVID came along, a bunch of scientists got together and said, okay, let's develop a vaccine, and a year later, poof, we have a vaccine. There's been all sorts of really interesting research, a lot of which I don't understand, on the genetic manipulation of this new style of vaccines. And now what they're actually saying is, because of this new style of vaccine, we will be getting all vaccines significantly quicker than we would have before, because they have a new style of vaccine. So the first thing is that why we got a vaccine quickly is complicated. But the second thing is the question of, who do you trust? And if the person you trust is in the White House, you're going to be more open to what they say. If the person you distrust is in the White House, you're going to be less open. And that, we, you know, think about for a second, Ashley, how you make decisions, right? Sometimes you make decisions because you have a conviction about something, but sometimes you make decisions by talking to your friends, looking at what they do, getting a sense of how they would act in similar situations. And, you know, there have been plenty of times where I have said to my wife, for example, I don't know what to do. What should I do with this instance? And then I just do it, right? I mean, sometimes, right? Sometimes we'll go to a restaurant and I'll just look at her and I'll say, what do I want? And she'll tell me, she'll look at the menu, she says, you want this? I'm like, oh, you're
right. I do that, you know, to my friend who works at Burn Bones.
Yeah, right?
So she orders for me every time.
it's you know, when you trust someone, you let them make decisions for you. And that's why President Trump's position on vaccine was so important, and why the dichotomy between him bad-mouthing the vaccine but also getting the vaccine in secret was so problematic, because his followers trust him, which is understandable. That's why they're his followers, just like people who support Biden trust Biden. That's why they're his followers. And so the social trust, the whole network of people that you were involved in, the wanting to behave in the same sort of range of actions as the people around you, all of this is going to affect people's attitudes about vaccines and whether they actively pursue it or not.
Would it be fair to say, though, that perhaps somebody who is vaccine hesitant or skeptic now is not just following down the party lines, and really, though, they might just be opposed to this specific style of development, this genetic manipulation? Is it fair that we're tossing them into a category of anti-science or only pro, you know, previous president?
So some of that is a case-by-case basis, right? I mean, if you have a conversation with someone who is informed about the research of the last 15 or 20 years and has all sorts of research and all sorts of evidence or clues as to why they hold that position, then, you know, you can give them a bit more credit on whatever answer they come up with. But if you're talking to someone whose idea of research is look at the same website all of the time, or they get all their news from memes like me, then it's a whole different issue. And so, you know, I can understand, of course, why anyone is hesitant to get any medication, right? I understand why someone is reluctant to put chemicals in their body or you know, bacteria in their body. At the same time, how justified your hesitancy is based also on the urgency, right? So let's say I don't like to drive at night, and I'm hesitant to drive at night because my eyesight isn't great. Okay, that's fine if we're deciding to go to a movie or going for a drive because we're bored, but it's a lot less relevant if you're driving someone to the hospital in an emergency. Mm. And so the hesitancy, the justification for the hesitancy is in direct relationship to how urgent what you're being hesitant about is. And so, you know, one of the things that doesn't get a lot of attention is the fact that with this vaccine rollout, this is the largest data set on vaccine that, you know, maybe we've ever had, right? Mm-hmm. In the sense that, I mean, you know, obviously we've seen over decades, you know, what the polio vaccine does and all that sort of stuff. But all of these people are getting all of these vaccines, and everything is being recorded and everything is being documented. And we're at hundreds of millions of people now. Mm-hmm. And there have been, you know, a handful of blood clots on the JJ vaccine and no serious issues with the Pfizer vaccine and a couple allergic reactions to people who had serious allergies to shellfish. Mm-hmm. Now, when you're talking about hundreds and hundreds of millions of people and the bad reactions are in the dozens, then the hesitancy becomes more about your personality and less about the facts.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and we're airing a conversation today with philosophy professor Jack Russell Weinstein as we talk about vaccines. Coming up after this break, we have a discussion about individual rights and societal responsibility.
With producers back in the fields operating large equipment this growing season, North Dakota's electric cooperatives remind you to watch for electric hazards. Overhead power lines are necessary to deliver electricity to hardworking farmers and ranchers, but those same power lines can also be deadly if not treated with respect. Use a spotter when operating large machinery near power lines. Keep equipment at least 10 feet from power lines in all directions at all times, and consider down lines energized. Be safe, be watchful. This message is brought to you by North Dakota's Electric Cooperatives and Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and my guest today is Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, a Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Dakota. And we chat monthly about a philosophical look at big news stories. And today's topic is on the COVID-19 vaccine, hesitancy versus skepticism, and the impacts on society. And I asked him about how we weigh out individual rights versus societal responsibility.
So this is one of the classical conundrums of political philosophy. You know, how do you balance your own individual interests and your own individual beliefs with the interests and beliefs of the community? And the classic individualist answer that comes out of John Stuart Mill, that's at the core of democratic theory, that's at the core of libertarianism, is you get to decide for yourself if what you're engaged in is what he calls self-regarding actions, mm-hmm. an action that only affects yourself. So the classic contemporary, or I guess the archetypical contemporary example of this is smoking marijuana, right? Many, many people feel that if you're sitting on your couch and you're having an edible or you're smoking a joint, that it doesn't affect anyone else, and so that the government's got no business making laws. Mm-hmm. That from a paternalistic perspective, you know, we're your parents, we think pot is wrong, you're not allowed to smoke it. That's very different than having an illness that when you're out and about, you can give to 5 people, 20 people, 50 people, you know, and that spreads at this radical rate. You know, I had, this is a little abstract, but I had a conversation 8 months ago or something with a friend who was, you know, talking about the overreaction to the vaccine. And one of the things I said is, look, your actions in, I'll say North Dakota, he wasn't in North Dakota, but your actions in North Dakota have a direct impact on the health of Syrian refugees in refugee camps, because the connectedness of our social activity means that someone can get sick on one side of the world and it can affect someone on the other side of the world. And since this is the exact—
How pandemics work.
Right. That's right. That's how pandemic works. That's why this is a pandemic and not just a really bad flu season or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are certainly absolute convictions that people are going to have that are at the moral core of their being, you know, that they're not going to cross that line. You know, if I was told, hey, you can create peace on earth, but you have to personally kill 100,000 people in Nicaragua, I couldn't do it, right? Because I don't think it's right to kill innocent people, period. You know, so there are certainly core moral beliefs that people don't want to cross. The question ultimately is this vaccine skepticism really related to that core moral beliefs, or are you what gets called virtue signaling? Are you really using this as a way to assert your political opinions, to sort of poke at the opposition and to let your neighbors and your friends know, hey, this is who you are, and you're advertising that to assert yourself over the community?
Sounds like a bumper sticker, but
Right. I mean,
public health.
I think that's a really, really important analogy, because there are a lot of people who are acting as if masks or lack thereof are bumper stickers. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, especially you get these people that the news covers. And I don't know how widespread this is, because if everyone did it, it wouldn't be news. But, you know, you get these people who wear masks that are made of mesh, you know, or wear masks that have holes in them. They're like, ha ha ha, I'm wearing a mask. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Those are bumper stickers. Right. Those are ways of engaging in political protest, which is, you're right, in a democracy. But it's not a position on science, and it's not a position on how you're concerned with other people. It's the desire. It's the equivalent of walking down the street in a protest, say, George Floyd, remember his name.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a question about science. That's a question about politics.
Is that a matter of then we're thinking emotionally instead of logically or rationally?
We in our culture tend to divide emotion and logic very radically, right? And separate the two, but it really doesn't work that way, because in order to have a logical argument, you have to care about what you're talking about. You have to be motivated by the desire to be reasonable, the desire to make good inferences. You have to care about something enough to have the argument. And emotions themselves are rational, right? So if I say to you, I'm scared of the vaccine, you can say to me, okay, that fear is rational, or that fear is irrational, and we can have a conversation. Let me give you a simple example. Someone I know who's very afraid of flying in a plane always says that she has to stay awake the entire plane ride, because the moment she falls asleep, the plane is going to crash out of the sky, fall out of the sky, right?
Yeah,
you know,
right.
And that's irrational, right? Another person I know who is afraid of flying actually said that her deepest fear was that the wings were going to just fall off. And so she did a sort of a fear of flying course online. And one of the things they focused on, the fact, which I didn't know at the time, was that wings are actually one piece. They're not, you know, one wing, you know, riveted onto the plane and the other ring riveted to the other side. It's all one piece. So it's impossible for the wings to just fall off, right? So, you know, the question is skepticism or hesitancy about vaccines the same kind of irrational emotion that fear of flying is? I don't think it is. I think that vaccine hesitancy is more rational, more understandable. At the same time, the fact that it is more understandable doesn't mean that in the end it's the right position or that it's acceptable. Again, you have to ask, why are you hesitant? Why are you skeptical? What's informing that decision?
Could we compare it, for example, someone who would get their child the polio vaccine but maybe not have their child get the Gardasil vaccine, which would prevent HPV, which is sexually transmitted? And there's an argument there, I think, that's possible to make, that it's behavior-based, and therefore there's a question of morality.
So there is definitely a difference between vaccines in that are communicable through non-intimate contact and vaccines that are communicable through other ways. And polio and COVID and other such things, you know, you can give it to someone without physically touching them. Cervical cancer, that the HPV, that is the result of HPV, that you have to have intimate contact. So you certainly can say, well, look, if I'm never going to engage in this, or I don't want my child to engage in this, the HPV vaccine is not necessary. But then you have to ask a different question, which is, has forbidding someone to do something ever stopped them from doing it, right? Or for, you know, telling your kid, well, you're, you know, if I didn't want my daughter to see the new Godzilla movie for whatever reason, the last thing I would do is say, you can't see the new Godzilla movie, because the very first thing she
the
did
best thing is, you should do is act like it's the coolest thing you could do.
That's absolutely right. That's right. Boy, you know, I love Godzilla.
Cool,
I'm going to tell all your friends I love Godzilla. Godzilla stops being cool immediately. I mean, it's the HPV thing is really interesting, because all the statistics show that the vast majority of teenagers who take the pledges to remain abstinence, the abstinence pledges, something like 90% of them lose their virginity within 6 months. And that there is actually a higher rate of sexual activity amongst, or certainly unprotected sexual activity, but I think sexual activity in general. No, let me rephrase that. There is an equivalent rate of sexual activity between people who identify as very religious teenagers and people who don't. There's a higher rate of unprotected sex amongst evangelicals and conservative teenagers than not. And there's all sorts of reasons that if we want to go down that rabbit hole, we can. And so the idea that my kid isn't going to be sexually active, therefore I'm not going to give them an HPV, or if I give them that vaccine, it will give them permission to be sexually active, that's just empirically false. And so at the end of the day, a lot of this rests on the facts in front of you and whether you are willing to trust those facts, and who told you those facts, and whether those people are trustworthy.
That's philosophy professor Jack Russell Weinstein as we talk about vaccines. And we'll have more after this break.
Like a newborn's first cry, the first words out of my mouth at Prairie Public made a joyful sound. Well, here we are, and are we glad? And while we weren't smoking cigars 40 years ago at KCND in Bismarck, the first station on what would eventually become the much-loved and trusted statewide public radio network you know today, we knew there was an audience hungry for something different on the radio. It has been my honor and privilege to lead a talented news team and be your voice and radio companion in the morning when you're getting ready and heading to work. Thanks for listening to Prairie Public. For 40 years, telling North Dakota and the region's stories.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and today we are talking about vaccines. And we are visiting with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, a philosophy professor at UND. And we are going to pick up this conversation now about the idea of bad science. And specifically, I mentioned that there was a time when doctors used to prescribe cocaine.
Science is a weird thing, because we tend to think of science as proving things true, but that's not how science works. Science works by a process of what's called falsification. In other words, you don't prove that things are true, you prove that things are not true. So let's take a simple example. I cannot prove to you that human beings need oxygen to live. What I can prove to you is that if you take oxygen away from human beings, they will die every single time. And so the inference that you make is that oxygen is necessary. The word theory, which often gets misused when we talk about it in science, theory doesn't mean an unproven idea, which is how people use it colloquially. Theory refers to a picture of the world that offers a connected and often comprehensive explanation of a phenomenon, right? And so in order for science to work, we have to make mistakes. And it's perfectly understandable to say, look, if the vaccine shows up 6 months after an illness, I'm going to be much more skeptical of a vaccine that's been around for 150 years. And that goes back to the thing that we talked about before, which is that the fact of the matter is this vaccine didn't show up 6 months ago. It showed it's been the work of thousands and thousands and thousands of people and hundreds of millions of dollars over decades and decades. Now, again, that doesn't mean that hesitancy isn't worth attending to. But when you're hesitant to something about something, it means your position is unresolved. It means you're still thinking about it. It means the possibility of acting is still there. That's why it's hesitancy. And skepticism, or even stronger, this refusal to do it, that's a finished position. That's a decision not to act. And those two positions are very, very different to say, hey, look, I'm actively looking into this. I'm a little concerned. I'm going to be cautious. I'm going to get this from a reliable source. I'm going to look and see how all of my friends act. So if you look at one of the early studies of the Republicans who were hesitant about the vaccine, what a bunch of them would say is they were thinking of taking it. They just wanted to see how it all played out for a while. I'm totally open to that. I'm totally open to this idea that, well, you know, let's see how this rolls out. Let's see how it works. Let's see if people turn into zombies or whatever, right? But that's a very different position than, no, this is evil. This is a plan. This is all designed to, you know, control us, and there's nothing that I can hear that will change my mind. And that actually in philosophy is one of the key ideas that's connected to falsification. If someone says to me, I refuse to take this vaccine, or I'm skeptical about this vaccine, I will say to them, what evidence do you need to change your mind? What do I have to show you? And then they give me a list, and then I can try to show them or not, right? This is why the question of God, you know, the belief of God is not a scientific question, because there is nothing that we can say. There's no empirical standards that we can lay out in advance to prove that God exists. But there are standards that we can use to show, as much as knowledge can show, that a vaccine is effective. So really the question is, if you are hesitant, is this your final position, or is this just a process that you're going through in order to decide what you're going to do? The second, I think, is more justified than the first.
When we look at something that is a final position or something that we are working through, especially when it's something that is, oftentimes related to a faith or a belief system, that can be fluctuating, I think is the word I want to use here. And I'm going to compare this with a person that I know and some Facebook posts that I have seen, where he was comparing being forced to get a vaccine to being raped. And he had a different post that indicated very much that he would be in the pro-life or anti-choice camp. And I know a lot of people on the pro-choice side of things would say, you can't force this medical condition on a woman, especially in the case of an actual rape. Do you see any kind of hypocrisy in those two positions coming from the same person?
Okay, so again, I want to sort of divide my answer into two pieces. The first part is I want to say something which I think is going to surprise people, which is I actually believe that religion and faith are rational. And what I mean by that is certainly at the core of our religious belief are propositions which cannot be proven. God exists, you know, it's wrong to murder, X, Y, and Z are moral or immoral things to do. But religion is a rational system because there are inferences and logical consequences based on those things. So let's say you are a very religious Christian, and the idea of loving a neighbor and turning the other cheek and laying down your life for someone else is core to your faith. Well, it's perfectly rational based on those beliefs to say, I'm hesitant about this vaccine, but loving my my neighbor means taking it even though I'm nervous. Caring for the kids in the neighborhood, being worried about people around the world are justifications enough for me to risk my life to care about other people, right? I think that that's a rational and logical consequence. So I want to be cautious about suggesting that any of this stuff is rooted or the necessary consequence of any particular faith or religion. Now, with that said, the other part in the rape analogy. Analogies are only viable if they make sense. And even if analogy starts with some commonality, it doesn't mean it ends up being a legitimate analogy. So to use a sort of technical term here, the idea of being poked with a needle and the idea of being raped is, in the first instance, both about penetration, right? Penetrating the skin, penetrating the body, right? There's a truth to that. But rape is not really about penetration. It's about power. It's about force. It's about belittling someone. It's about causing them psychological pain. And it's about having a tremendous long-lasting consequence that many victims never get over. Being pricked with a needle does not have those consequences. And, you know, if you're being shot up with some kind of poison, right? Then the wrong, the moral wrong is not the sticking the needle in the skin. It's the using the poison. So the analogy doesn't work. But what's really interesting about that example is that the position that this person comes to is exactly the position that he, I presume, is arguing against in terms of abortion. He's saying, you know, you shouldn't force me to take this medication. Everyone should have a choice. Now, A, no one in the United States is being forced to take to be vaccinated, right? That's been very, very clear. This is a matter of personal choice. And so anyone who says we're being forced is just wrong. But the second thing, now, there may be peer pressure. There may be bureaucratic requirements to enroll in a school, right? You know, UND and other universities say you have to be vaccinated to enroll, but there are other colleges and universities you can go to. You have other choices, right? So, but ultimately this question of you have the choice to do it, if you want to say you have the choice to reject or accept a medical procedure, then the question becomes, do you have to hold to that with other medical procedures and with things like abortion? The problem ultimately, and this goes back to the beginning of our conversation, the Republican position, just like the Democratic position, is not consistent, right? The various different things that people hold, and this is true of religions, this is true of, you know, science to a certain extent, this is true of all large-scale beliefs, is that they will hold things to be true at the same time that seem contradictory, seem hypocritical, and that we have to take, piecemeal bit by bit. The difference between science and all of these other positions, including the political and the religious positions, is science's goal is to make everything consistent in the end. The method of science, the research, the reproducibility, the worldwide conversation between scientists is to create a theory that is 100% consistent with no internal contradictions, and that when you see a contradiction, you have to reject part of the theory. You have to reject one of those contradictions. Politics and religion, it doesn't work that way. You can hold contradictory beliefs and still say, well, these are my beliefs, because they serve different purposes than the discovery and dissemination of truth.
What about this idea of other people who might be vaccine hesitant from the perspective of not looking at disease reaction, and would rather see a healthier populace, with the theory being that healthier people, if we focused on diet, exercise, water consumption, et cetera, we would be less prone to some of these diseases or some of these diseases being as bad as they are. And I don't know entirely if that would be specific to COVID-19, but certainly someone who is very unhealthy is at a lot higher risk for complications than for somebody who is healthy.
I love this question because this question is the entire debate wrapped up in, you know, one small package, right? Because it brings two different issues to the fore. The first is it possible to, through diet, behavior, and preventative medicine, not get COVID? The evidence suggests not. The evidence suggests that certainly there are risk factors, that if you're a smoker, if you are heavier, if you have diabetes, that you're more likely to have extreme reactions. Mm-hmm. But also there's age is involved and there's some argument about genetic proclivities and all of that sort of stuff. So on the one hand, it doesn't matter how many miles you run and how many carrots you eat. You're going to get COVID if you're going to get COVID, right? On the other hand, a lot of people, certainly not all of them, a lot of people with diabetes have diabetes because of behavior. And if they did different things and they didn't have diabetes, the evidence suggests that maybe they'd have statistically a less reaction. Footnote here, when I say statistically, what I mean is if you look at the great numbers, because we know nothing about any individual people in advance, right? Statistics don't tell us what happens in any one case. It just tells us what the odds are. But at the same time, the kind of thing that you're talking about, and this is one of the reasons why I love the question so much, is that if what you're arguing for is preventative medicine and preventive behavior, then what you're arguing for is a massive revolution in our healthcare system, right? That first of all, everyone gets free healthcare. Everyone gets checkups every year. All of a sudden, you know, there should be vegetables and other healthier foods should be cheaper rather than the most expensive thing in the grocery store. You know, I myself, I talked about this on Y Radio a couple times. I was diagnosed with high cholesterol, and one of the ways I responded to it was by becoming an amateur triathlete, right? And getting fit and losing weight. Now, because I'm a professor, I have the time to do this. Because I have a good job, I have the money to do this. That's not open to many, many, many people. So I am incredibly lucky and privileged to have that option. But certainly I am an example of someone who's engaged in preventative behavior. But if we really care about that, then maybe my gym membership should be covered by my insurance plan. Or maybe I should get reduced rates because I swim twice a week, right? If what we want is preventative medicine, and I mean this in the large scale, not just, you know, pharmacology, not just, but also eating healthy, having, you know, lowering stress, being surrounded by people you love, mm-hmm. Having you need bike lanes, right? You need big shoulders on the road so that people can bike safely. You need to be able to walk to work. You need public transportation, right? And you need a wholesale revolution in the American healthcare industry. And you can see all of this stuff work in especially the Scandinavian countries, where people are in general healthier, where they have this infrastructure, where healthcare is free, but where people did get COVID, in fact, at a higher rate in Sweden in particular than other places, because the response to COVID was bad on the public policy level. And so long answer, right? Not concise, not short, right? Long answer. Preventative medicine requires us to rethink our entire healthcare system. But even if we were to do that and we ended up in like one of the Scandinavian countries, we would still all be as susceptible to COVID as we are now, because there's some illnesses that prevention just doesn't work and it's just a matter of bad luck.
Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein is a Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Dakota and the host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. And he joins us monthly to give a deep philosophical dive into a current news event. Jack, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure as always. Thank you, Ashley.
when you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And imagine for a moment that feeling that you have when you are hungry. It's easy to get irritable. It's easy to lose your ability to focus. Now imagine if you had that feeling often. We are going to talk about hunger and expanded access to food now with the Great Plains Food Bank Program Director, Nancy Caravu. Nancy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
2021, you will be expanding your Youth Summer Meals Program. So for starters, what is the Youth Summer Meals Program?
Yeah, the Youth Summer Meals, what that does is it's a way to provide meals for kiddos in the summer that normally rely on the school lunches that they get during the school year. And we are one of many programs across the state that provide summer meals. A lot of the schools do it, YMCAs, Boys and Girls Clubs, and we help provide in some of those gap communities that might not have a school participating in the program or that operates past the summer school months. And so we help make sure that those kids are getting the food they need throughout summer as well, because they are busy and running around and need lots of food to eat.
How do you know how many kids to anticipate feeding?
We really rely heavily on our community partners in those communities. So we find a community champion that knows that community well, you know, who the kids are in that neighborhood, wherever we do it, because we do these all based on different neighborhoods. And so either they've been in that district and have worked with the schools, or they have community programming that they already offer that we couple with. And so then we're able to just kind of, we do a little guesstimate, you know, we might guess that there's 50 kids in that neighborhood that will need it. And then that might increase a little bit each time, but we're also able to pull free and reduced numbers in neighborhoods and kind of get an idea of where those kids are located. And that's really how we gauge where to go.
And how do you classify the need in North Dakota specific to young people?
Yeah, and so we really look at those free and reduced numbers and know where there's kids that are needing that assistance with the schools to be able to provide them the meals. And then that's where we go and serve those meals. And this year, differently than in years past, we're able to expand because typically we can only go to communities that are deemed eligible by USDA. And USDA has removed all of those waivers due to COVID. And so while we know that there is a need in a community, if it's not census data driven to show it has a need, we aren't necessarily eligible to do those meals there. So we're really fortunate that we can expand where we know that there's a need with kids needing food in multiple different neighborhoods across the state this year.
So you've gone from 7 to this year now you'll have more than double that. You'll have 18 locations. Going back to those waivers that were removed by the USDA because of the pandemic, why are they there?
That's a really great question. And so, you know, we've benefited from this and schools have benefited from this. So you may have seen, you know, how schools have been allowed to give meals away at the school to take home during the distance learning time. Mm-hmm. It's those same waivers. They affect us just the same. So they, you know, there's a lot of reasons that USDA has some of these waivers in place to for eligibility reasons. And so that's all based on, they do income-based guidelines. They do some other guidelines of kids usually typically have to stay and eat the meals for a half hour on site. So different nutritional guidelines that they have that they waived all that. So we're able to have a kiddo can come to us on a Monday and get meals for 5 days. So instead of having to come back Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, we can give them 5 meals, shelf-stable meals on one day to take home. So there's been a lot of barriers removed that's been allowing us to serve so many more kids. So we're really hoping that we can help have these conversations to ensure that some of the things stay this way and that we don't go back to the way we used to do it.
Yeah. Normal is just what you're used to, right? Not necessarily what's right.
Yeah, exactly.
How does this change the staffing and volunteer and food needs? How are you able to meet this increased ability to serve?
Yeah, that's a great question. So So we very much rely on our community partners that help us with this. So like, for instance, in West Fargo, we have a great partnership with the Little Red Reading Bus. The Little Red Reading Bus is operated by the West Fargo Education Foundation, and they go to different neighborhoods already and do a library on wheels. And so we've found it really beneficial when we partner with these already existing network of community partnerships, and they now serve the meals and do a farmer's market with that. And so we wouldn't have the staffing capacity to do what we were able to do this year without hiring more. So we really lean on some of those community partnerships that are already doing some of the work with kids that can help just also get meals out, and then makes it for a really easy transition into doing that. And we have a really great volunteer force of folks that help.
How did you pick the communities that you'll be expanding into? Granora, Trenton, Castleton, Mapleton, among others.
Yeah, and so some of it's been if they reach out to us and the express need from the community. Granora and Trenton are super exciting for us because we have never done summer meals past that Bismarck line. So we are extending as far west as we can possibly go now. We had had an original granting opportunity to do some additional work out there. But then this, we had some community partners that were really excited about it, and they're anticipating serving over 100 children a week, and that's incredible out in those really tiny little communities out there. They're not very big, but they know that there's a lot of kids that are in need. And so we did look at those free and reduced numbers out there, and they are higher. And so once we were able to identify that and identify the community partners, it was just a no-brainer to help get those meals out there.
What happens to the brain, the just emotional development of a kid with food insecurity?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we know that kids that are going hungry and that aren't getting enough food to eat, it's harder for them to concentrate. It's harder for them, you know, they're going to be more tired during the school day. They might not sleep as well at night, and they just have a harder time functioning like a kiddo that's getting all the meals that they need to do. And so we've been able to show that kids that are getting access to these meals or access to, you know, our backpack program or school pantries are coming to school feeling like they can participate and thrive during the school year and just during the day, and feel like they can just feel like a normal kid. You know, they just get to feel like a normal kid like everyone else and not worry about being hungry and where they're going to get food for themselves and for their siblings.
You talked about these kids have the opportunity now, for example, to show up on Monday and get a full week's worth of meals instead of having to come every single day, which could be some kind of transportation logistic hassle or what have you. So let's talk about balancing, planning out these meals. You want shelf stable so that they last all week, but there has to be an element of ability to cook it, and then also the element of typically the healthiest food is the least shelf stable. So how do you balance these?
Yeah, we've practiced and tried lots of different ways of doing this, and there are different different meal programs throughout the state that do different ways. So a lot of the schools and the YMCAs and things like that do get cooked, like a full cooked meal that they'll serve, you know, whether it's through their lunch line or through a lunch program that they have on site. We had tried that once ourselves, but we don't cook meals ourselves. And so we've found to really expand on our backpack program we do, which we work with vendors that really have worked hard to create shelf-stable food that can be a lot more nutritious, less sodium, less sugar, more whole grains, some fruits and vegetables in there as well, that don't require either a lot of cooking or can be just eaten kind of like a healthy version, shelf-stable version of like a lunch bowl. Like there's like a pizza kit they can get or a hummus and crackers. So we have different options that they can have through that, and we are constantly evaluating those to see what's the best opportunity to get for them. But yeah, the challenge is a lot of those community partners we work with might not have storage for anything that would not be shelf-stable, so to have coolers and freezers to store food. But there's definitely a lot of vendors that we work with that provide lots of options because they work with food banks all over the country that do similar programs as us. But we've definitely made lots of changes over the years to ensure that we are getting the highest quality food for the kids and listening to them, what they don't like and like, because they definitely tell you.
They are good at that.
They are. And then interestingly, we also do a farmer's market at a couple of our sites. So we provide fresh fruits and vegetables to them as well to take home on a weekly basis. So that helps balance them and to get some fresh food.
Yeah, the pandemic certainly highlighted a lot of, gaps, let's just say, in our food system. And there has been a little bit of a resurgence of people interested in growing their own food. Has that at all impacted your work, your donations at all?
Yeah, we get quite a few local growers, whether it's your backyard gardener or your master gardener or your some of our larger farmers, like even our corn growers that grow corn and then they grow a little sweet corn on the side. Those donations are wonderful and we love them. And they've, you know, we saw a little bit of an increase in some of them last year. And then we are always looking for more healthy, fresh produce to go to our food pantry partners across the state and to us. And so that's a super exciting thing that we're always looking for more opportunities to, you know, sometimes we can help get volunteers for folks to help pick some of that produce if they have a lot of it. You know, a whole couple of rows of corn can take a little bit longer to pick. So it's nice to be able to help find volunteers. But that's wonderful. It's always something we're trying to increase with our network.
I was reading your bio on the Great Plains Food Bank website, and you are very open about your own food insecurity issues that came about after your child was born. And there is so much shame, so much stigma that can be associated with needing SNAP benefits, formerly known as the food stamps, or being on the WIC program. Why is it so important to share the story of a hardworking married mother who needs benefits like this?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's one thing, you know, we know there's, I had a mentor one time in my life that told me in some other work I did, she said, Nancy, we're always one, you know, one drop of a coin away from being on the other side of where we are and needing these assistance services, whatever that might be, if that's food assistance, if that's SNAP, if that's housing assistance, because we never know what life is going to throw you. And you may be the most fortunate person ever, but knowing that you, we are no different than each other and that a lot of us fall on times that we're needing help. And so if we can be in neighborhoods and communities that provide that and can support each other and break down those shame and all the shame that goes with it, right? Because there's a lot of shame that goes along with asking for help and needing support. And it's just really important to me to be able to share that information and be transparent about it. And there's been quite a few of us at the food bank that have been able to share those stories because we know that it exists, but we also know that with the right help and assistance, people can get out of that as well.
Nancy Caravu is the Great Plains Food Bank Program Director, and she joined me today to talk about an expansion of the Youth Summer Meals Program. Nancy, congratulations on being able to expand the program, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Been a pleasure.
That's it for this weekend edition of Main Street. Coming up Monday at our 3 o'clock Central Time Zone, it is Memorial Day, and we will hear a project from the National Endowment for the Arts and their effort to tell more soldiers' stories. That's coming up Monday on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your weekend.